Good morning. On today's programme, tensions on the Brenner Pass and India's response to protests about the Israel-Hamas conflict. But first we go to Poland, and yesterday marked Polish Independence Day, a celebration of Poland's re-emergence on the map of Europe in 1918 after more than a century of partition and occupation by its neighbours. Ceremonies and military processions were held across the country, but in recent years the spectacle of a far-right march in the capital Warsaw has grabbed the headlines. After a divisive general election last month, Independence Day serves as a reminder for many Poles of a time when their country reunified and regained independence against all odds. From Warsaw, Liam Nolan reports.
Red flares lit up the evening sky in central Warsaw yesterday as tens of thousands of people took part in an ultranationalist march to mark Polish Independence Day. It looked as if an inferno was engulfing the city's Poniatowski Bridge as participants walked east across the Vistula River holding Polish flags. In recent years, the march, which is organised by Polish far-right groups, has resulted in violent confrontations between participants and police. Members of the ultra-nationalist National Radical Camp occupied the centre of the march, waving the group's black flags. Along the route, banners displayed anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQ messages. Another read "Stop the Ukrainization of Poland," and one huge banner called for a Pole exit, a term used for a Polish exit from the European Union, which has very little support in Poland. Parents with young children took part, but most participants were young men wearing armbands in the colours of the Polish flag. The spectacle of thousands of flare-waving far-right supporters taking over central Warsaw tends to grab the headlines. But wreath-laying ceremonies and military processions are held across the country on what is generally an important and peaceful day for many Poles. When World War I ended on November the 11th, 1918, Poland re-emerged on the map of Europe after 123 years of occupation by its neighbours. In the late 18th century, one by one, Prussia, Austria-Hungary and Imperial Russia had carved up Poland, dividing it into three. With the surrender of Germany and Austria-Hungary in November 1918, and Russia already out of the war, a Polish general named Józef Piłsudski assumed control of the country and formed a new independent government. Paweł Skibiński, a historian and author of the book Poland 1918, tells me that 1918 is the great date in Poland's history because unification, he says, had been almost politically impossible. The state that was reconstituted in 1918, the Polish Second Republic, was very different to the Poland of today. For one, it encompassed territory that today makes up Western Ukraine, Belarus and Lithuania. The country was also ethnically diverse, with sizable Ukrainian, Polish Jewish, German and Belarusian minorities. The Second Republic lasted only 21 years, cut short by Nazi Germany's invasion in 1939, which led to World War II. After that war, communist authorities banned commemorations on November 11th, lest it awaken calls for a democratic and independent Poland. But November 11th became a national holiday again, after free elections in 1989. Poland held a divisive general election last month, in which the ruling nationalist Law and Justice Party lost its majority. A centrist and left-wing bloc of parties, led by former Prime Minister Donald Tusk, looks set to form the next government, but only after Law and Justice tries to win a vote of confidence in the next 2 weeks. On Friday evening, Law and Justice held its own event in Warsaw to commemorate Independence Day. The party's leader, Jarosław Kaczyński, spoke in vague terms next to a statue of Piłsudski, the founding father of the Polish state in 1918, saying that Polish independence was now under threat. In contrast, Mr. Tusk called for unity in a speech on social media yesterday. On November the 11th each year, most Poles can cast aside their political differences and remember a time when their country was miraculously unified and reborn. For World Report, this is Liam Nolan in Warsaw.
Next, we go to Italy. The Brenner Pass is a major European transport route, a mountain pass linking Italy and Austria. But heavy traffic on the mountain highway has led to tensions with people who live close to the pass and who have to endure the noise and disruption caused by the thousands of heavy trucks which use the road every day. Restrictions placed on the trucks by Austria have also led to conflict with Italy, which has threatened legal action against its neighbour. From Italy, Yusuf Kutiar reports.
The Saddleberg Hike, located at Italy's last frontier with Austria, isn't something you'll find instantly in your travel guide. Besides the mountain views, it provides a bird's-eye view of one of Europe's busiest links, the Brenner Pass, a highway connection that starts in Italy and snakes through the Alps into Austria. While crisscrossing this mountain, you can't help but notice the ceaseless droning, without any breather, of vehicles zipping north or south of the pass, with the occasional ding-dong at the Brenner's Lego-like train station reverberating across the valley. Last year, 2.5 million trucks crossed the pass together with 11.8 million private vehicles. Austria's Tyrol region took matters into its hands and laid out restrictions on transit trucks, curbs that include a total ban on night driving and during weekends. Karl Mühlsteiger is the mayor of Gries am Brenner, a tightly knit community that lives under the shadow of the Brenner Pass Bridge on the Austrian side. Traffic is a dominating factor in the residents' lives, Mühlsteiger said. Traffic is so egregious that residents plan when to go do their groceries to avoid the exodus of vehicles, he added. According to Mühlsteiger, there are two dominating factors as to why trucks choose this pass. The toll and gas in Austria are relatively cheaper when compared to other alpine passes, making it an attractive route. Certain short-sight actions rub salt in the wound. According to Mühlsteiger, some products like potatoes are harvested in Tyrol, hop on a truck to be cleaned in Italy, and then hop back to be sold in Germany. Things like this just don't make any sense and aggravate the problem. These thoughts were mirrored across the border by his Italian counterpart, Martin Albert, the mayor of Brennero. According to Albert, his community is happy with Austria's restrictions because at least there's some respite from the noise and air pollution. Italy's transport minister and deputy prime minister, however, is on the opposite end of the matter. In October of this year, Matteo Salvini forged ahead towards the Brenner border to voice his dismay against the Austrian restrictions and express his sympathy with truck drivers. Salvini wants to drag the neighboring country to the European Court of Justice. Austria is hindering the free movement of goods and services in the EU, Salvini said. Back in June, Austria's mobility minister, Leonor Gewissler, noted that the EU treaties don't demand that goods be transported on trucks all the time. Albert and Salvini locked horns at the border, and Brennero's mayor objected to Salvini's claim. I cannot agree with Salvini. I am defending the opposite of what he stands for. According to Albert, Salvini's priority is to increase the activity across this alpine pass. But for the nearby communities, this is unacceptable. Despite all this bickering, there may yet be light at the end of the tunnel. The regional governors of Bavaria, Tyrol and South Tyrol have proposed a booking slot system for trucks. Although it would be a step in the right direction, both mayors aren't fully convinced this would ease the burden. Both have their fingers crossed for the completion of the Brenner-based tunnel that's currently in the works. Once completed, this feat of engineering would be crowned the world's longest rail tunnel, stretching up to 64 kilometers from Fortezza in Italy, puncturing the Alps and seeing the light of day in Innsbruck, Austria. Mühlsteiger said that things shouldn't just stop with the opening of the tunnel. He called for higher toll rates and for goods to be transported on rails rather than on tarmac. This Herculean task has encountered several hiccups, but in spite of this, it is expected to be completed in a decade. This is Yosef Kotayer in Brennero for World Report.
Finally to India, and on the Israel-Hamas conflict, India has replicated the balancing act that it previously demonstrated when dealing with Russia's ongoing war against Ukraine. It abstained from voting on the UN resolution that called for a humanitarian truce and ceasefire in Gaza. The conflict has evoked strong reactions amongst the people of India, with scores of demonstrations across the country for both sides, Israel as well as the people of Palestine. But as Shalu Yadav reports from Delhi, the protests raising voices for Gaza are being singled out and suppressed by the government, signalling a shift in its historically balanced position on the war.
Just days after Israel responded to the Hamas attack of October 7th, protests started erupting on the streets of India, some defending Israel and some condemning its action in Gaza. While protests are seen as a hallmark of democracies around the world, the Indian government's selective action on those showing solidarity with Palestine has raised questions on that notion. Dozens of people who protested outside the embassy of Israel last month in Delhi were met with strong police action. They were manhandled and packed into police vehicles for detention, while those who came out in support of Israel saw no resistance by the police or the government. These demonstrators were mostly those who subscribe to the right-wing ideology and believe that India should become a land only for the Hindus, just as Israel became a land exclusively for Jews. They went to the length of offering themselves to Israel and said that they are ready to go to the front line and fight the Hamas. The right-wing demonstrations expressed solidarity with those killed during the October 7th attack by Hamas, but they quickly turned into a platform for spreading Islamophobia in the country. Hate speeches were made during such demonstrations, falsely linking Hamas, citizens in Gaza, and Muslims in India. The overall support for Israel was lauded by its diplomats in India, who said that it warmed their hearts to see so many Indians standing with them. But India's diversity of opinions demonstrated itself at various protests in other states that are not ruled by the ruling Hindu nationalist BJP party. At a rally in the southern state of Kerala, a Hamas leader appeared on video to share a stern message to Israel. This prompted strong reactions from Israel and caused a political furore in India, with some politicians asking for legal action against the organizers of the rally, calling it anti-national. It's interesting and important to mention here that India has never officially designated Hamas as a terrorist organization, and it has historically supported the two-state solution in the region. Father of the nation, Mahatma Gandhi, had opposed the creation of an Israeli state, fearing it would be unfair to the Palestinians. In fact, India voted against it at the UN and only got around to recognizing Israel in 1950. And it took another few decades for India to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. But analysts say that there's been an unofficial shift in India's position since 2014, when Prime Minister Modi came to power. The defence relations with Israel have grown leaps and bounds. India reportedly buys $2 billion worth of arms from Israel every year, making it its largest arms supplier after Russia. And it is in this backdrop that Israel has found the confidence to urge India to officially designate Hamas as a terrorist organization. But India has maintained a calculated silence on this plea. After India's successful stint at hosting the G20 and managing to come up with a joint declaration despite huge differences amongst countries over Russia-Ukraine war, the world leaders expect India to play a much bigger role on global issues. While Israel and America would wish for India to take a stand with them, Palestinian leaders and the Arab world expects it to mediate to stop the conflict from escalating. But it's been hard to read the mind of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi on this matter. He was one of the first world leaders to extend solidarity with Israel in the aftermath of the attack on October 7th. But it took its government a few days to clarify India's historically balanced position on the conflict. Some would say that it's the same playbook that India adopted when the Ukraine-Russia war began. Despite continued pressure from the Western world, it refused to take sides and rather took a position of non-position, reflecting the complexities in a multipolar world. As Prime Minister Modi heads into a crucial election year in a few months, it begs the question whether he will allow domestic jingoism to shape the country's foreign policy. He's walking a tightrope, which might make it tough for him to balance the question of morality with political necessity. For World Report, this is Shalu Yadav in Delhi.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.